Most of you received the newsletter, so I won't go over all of the other details, and I probably can't pronounce any all the words as it is that were in there. But John will share more of this with you. However, John has just had a book of his recently published, well, not too long ago, by Sumeru Press. It's called The Driftwood Shrine, Discovering Zen in American Poetry. I had not even seen this book until this past Wednesday, and Mike Oatley shared it with me. He brought it to a book club I attend. It's the first collection of Zen teachings to be based on the poems of great American writers. Reassuring, forthright, and often surprising language, John explains how Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, William Carlos Williams, yeah, the Red Wheelbarrow, and many other poets enshrine the gentle light of the Buddha's teaching in their work. Stephen Batchelor, author of After Buddhism, said about the book, rather than treating Zen as an exotic import from the East, this wonderful series of meditations discerns and extracts its essence from the heart of American poetry. John Wolfe teaches English composition, creative writing, a wide variety of literature courses, and an experimental course in intrapersonal communications called Mindful Living. All of this at West Shore Community College in Ludington, Michigan. His current research and teaching interests center on the intersection of web research, humanitarian computing, and meditation and mindfulness in educational settings. John Wolfe earned the Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Cincinnati, Master's of Arts from the University of Colorado, and a Master of Fine Arts from the University of Montana. I believe that's in Missoula, isn't it? Great, great country, where he studied creative writing. And he says the following about his life. My life is characterized by some seemingly long intertwined vines of contrasting, if not competing, interests and activities. These include my enduring love of writing of all kinds, but especially of poetry, my firm commitment to the transformational power of education, the curiously creative and powerful ability of contemporary technology to stimulate and amplify our teaching and learning, and my now 30-year commitment to Zen practice. So let us all welcome John Wolfe to our pulpit this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. Reverend Dowd and his wife Catherine have been very gracious, and I can detect that there is a lot of love in this congregation, something I really appreciate, especially today when the truth will out, especially today when we need it so much. But for me, it's a privilege and an honor to be here today, and I appreciate you giving me this opportunity to share some thoughts with you. When we were first thinking about this sermon that I would give, it was suggested that I talk to you about my personal journey into Zen Buddhism, and so that's what I'm going to do. We usually don't talk about ourselves, make ourselves the topic of a talk, I should say, but I think there's some relevance here. And I'll read a bit, actually, from the Driftwood Shrine, because the first chapter of that book has to do with how one does begin that spiritual journey. So I was thinking about that personal spiritual journey, and I was thinking, well, it is, in fact, very personal. No one can do it for you. You have to decide that you're going to do it. You can't just inherit a truth. You could respect it, admire it, but you're going to have to decide individually, I choose to commit to this path, whatever the path is. It's like a turnstile. You know, people can't go through the turnstile for you. I remember when I was a little boy, first time encountering one of those things, you push the bar and it whirls around, right? One person at a time goes through. Well, my mother was right behind me and she had to tell me what to do. She couldn't do it for me. I had to do it myself. So I figured that out. And I think it's an apt metaphor for that decision that we make on an individual basis to proceed. But just because it's a personal decision and a personal spiritual journey that we go on doesn't mean that it's solitary. We're all here together because we see some advantage in that, and that is also true in the Zen tradition that I'm part of. It's a very important part. So we emphasize meditation in our practice tradition. It's silent introspection. There's not much talking, but we come together to do it because there's an energy there when everybody is sitting, we call it sitting, when everybody is meditating together. It's like all of you are here together. So we go through that turnstile on a personal basis. But there may be a bank of turnstiles, and they're out in the open air, and we can see each other, and we can guide each other, and we can talk to each other as we all proceed through individually. And we really need it. Nobody does it alone. Even the Buddha, the founder of my tradition, did not do it alone. So why do we do it? This is an important question for me. It always has been. Why? Why did I do this? How many Americans are going to dress like this and do this arduous practice? It's what we call, in my tradition, seeking the ox, hence the title of the sermon, seeking the ox, because in ancient China, where Zen originated, the ox was a symbol for the true self. And someone, at some point several centuries ago, painted a series of 10 pictures, and they're called the ox herding pictures. And what those pictures are meant to represent are the different stages of the spiritual path, because we do this together and we help each other. And it's sometimes nice to know what the milestones are. A help. One of the first images in that series of 10 ox herding pictures is of a man, is not an ox at all. By the way, by the word ox, we tend to mean the animal we probably think of as the water buffalo. Very large, very powerful, potentially very dangerous, could kill you, very strong. Well, that first picture is of a man wandering around in the woods looking for the ox that has gone missing. And this is an important part of the Buddha's primary teaching, which we call the Four Noble Truths. Now let me be a little more precise. We have a feeling, a niggling sense that something's missing in our lives. If we didn't have that feeling, we wouldn't come here. We come here to get something that we think we don't have. Now, when we translate the original teaching into English concerning that feeling, it gets translated as the word suffering. which in English conveys a rather deep form of misery. And in the Buddha's day, it meant that too, but it also meant subtler feelings of dissatisfaction, things you can't quite put your finger on, but you know it's not perfect yet. That's suffering. And so the Buddha said, there are four things you need to know. The first one is, life is characterized by suffering. The second one is, suffering is caused by our craving, our wanting to have things we don't have, or our wanting to be rid of things we don't want. The third truth, call them the noble truths again, the third truth was that you can end that craving. And the fourth truth is, the way that you end it is you follow the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, it were eight practices that Buddhists all over the world still today practice in order to relieve themselves of their self-clinging, basically, their desires. It's not that we don't have desires, it's the clinging to the desire that creates the suffering. So when you walk out of the ice cream shop and somebody bumps into you and your ice cream cone falls on the sidewalk, you suffer a little bit. Or if you're seven, you suffer a lot. Or if you're me, you suffer a lot. Because I think I should have that ice cream. I think that that should not have happened. Ultimately, that is what I'm thinking. But it happened. That's life. So there are the Four Noble Truths. And we want to pursue those truths so that we reach some state, you might call it the summum bonum, some perfect good. In my tradition might be enlightenment or nirvana. Maybe it's the promised land or heaven. But we want to get to something. We came to get something. We practice to get something. And as we are going along this long, winding, muddy, rocky road we call the spiritual path, we can be encouraged by what we think about the final destination. So I want to read to you a poem about that final state. It was written by a 19th century American named Jones Very. He was a transcendentalist poet, friends with Ralph Waldo Emerson and others, a very evangelical Christian. It's one of the most beautiful poems I've ever read, and even though my book is a book of Buddhist teachings, it actually starts with a poem by a Christian. The poem is called The Lost. Now I'll warn you, hearing this just once, it might be a little hard to grasp, but I invite you to just try to let it come into you gently. The Lost. The fairest day that ever yet has shone will be when thou the day within shalt see. The fairest rose that ever yet has blown, when thou the flower thou lookest on shalt be. But thou art far away among time's toys. Thyself the day thou lookest for in them, thyself the flower that now thine eye enjoys, but wilted now thou hang'st upon thy stem. The bird thou hearest on the budding tree, thou hast made sing with thy forgotten voice. But when it swells again to melody, the song is thine in which thou wilt rejoice. And thou, new risen, midst these wonders live, that now to them dost all thy substance give. Basically saying that the rose of perfection that you see in the garden is actually you. You're not different from it. The problem is we're lost among time's toys. Our toys come to us as houses, cars, clothes, food, friendships, loves, and pleasant weather. One by one, each toy becomes the object of our self-clinging or attachment. And one by one, our toys disappear or change, or we change, and our suffering begins. Our toys are ephemeral, unlasting. Yet we go on, year after year, persisting in a belief that a fixed state of happiness can be wrangled from an unfixed reality. We think, and we are encouraged by numerous social mores to think, that the accumulation of material wealth and the control of our outward circumstances will produce some future contentment. We think, in other words, that happiness is derivative, to be derived from these things. But you wouldn't be here, I say again, if that were true. You all have things. Did you come in a car? You have that. It's not enough. So on this personal spiritual journey, we could spend a lot of time being very confused about how we should proceed, how we should move forward, how to take a step, in what direction should we go. I was going to read a little passage here about something that happened to me. This actually happened. I think I'll just paraphrase it. I was a college student in Cincinnati. It was summertime, and I had gone home to visit my parents. They lived out in the countryside, and near their house was a large woods, and I used to love to go walking in there. And I had been there many times. But this one day, I went there, and was walking around, and I came upon this kind of opening in the trees, and it was a grove of birch trees. And so they're thinner trees, and the light was shining there, and there was some tall grass, and I just lay down, and I took a little nap there. No, I didn't sleep for 100 years. It's not a Rip Van Winkle story. Although I think I've been alive for about 400 years, but that's what I tell my students, and they believe it. But I took a nap. When I woke up, it was time to go. I got up. I started to walk back. And I kept walking, and I thought, where's the fence? There was some kind of broken barbed wire fence I used to follow to get back to the road. Well, it wasn't there. So I kept walking, and I was feeling a little fuzzy and confused. And all of a sudden, I came up upon another opening in the trees, and it was a birch grove, the same one. Okay, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. My dad warned me that this can happen to people. He's been lost in the woods, too. So I start out again. This time I'm like really paying attention to my landmarks, and I start walking. And you're not going to believe it, but it's really true. I came upon an opening in the trees, birch trees, long grass, and now I was freaked out. I could not stop walking in circles, no matter how straight I had tried the second time. I still was walking in a circle. And this, to me, is the nature of the path. Does that ring true for you? You keep coming back to the same thing every single time? Thank you. At that point, I sat down. I just sat. I just, okay, calm down, calm down, calm down. And I was meditating, loosely speaking, trying to figure it out. I really had to calm down. And then I did get home after that, obviously. It can be like that. But we have to figure out how we're going to proceed. And the way that we do that in the Zen tradition is by looking in. We turn our light inward in the practice of meditation. We still the mind. It doesn't go blank exactly, but we still it so that we can actually look at the reality we're living. That's why we do it. And then we might get a glimpse. We might see what is in the second ox herding picture, which are the tracks of the ox in the mud. And the third one is kind of funny. It's the man looking through the trees, and he sees a tail, just the tail of the ox, a glimpse. Now I know which way to go to find my true self. And eventually he captures the ox, puts a rope around its neck, struggles with it. This is like Jacob wrestling with the angel on the banks of the river. Brings it home, and then lets it go. So there is this destination that we have in our minds, but there's something else that's really important here, and that's what happens before we go through that turnstile I was talking about. There is a transformational moment that causes us to even think that we want to engage in this personal spiritual journey. Now for me, that also happened in college, and I'm going to read you a little bit here. It embarrasses me to read it still now because I'm just so far away from it. It doesn't even seem like me, but it did happen. There was a time I remember when I looked down from the top of my high-rise college dormitory, working up the nerve to jump. Got it? I had alienated my friends, neglected my studies, and had not a clue as to how the whole business of living was supposed to be conducted. In the distance, the thin, barely discernible line of the Ohio River gleamed in the late afternoon light. A lonely barge stilled itself on its brightness. Below, the traffic of the city honked and roared while the nameless thousands of people walked, talked, and thought through their world as though it were an easily navigated path. But for me, life had become inexplicably agonizing. I was lost. To be lost like that, lost within your own life, is to have no business anywhere else. It is to be alone. And so, all alone, I had fallen into a kind of blackness that consumed my days. I was too young to manage such overwhelming darkness and too far gone into despair to imagine how things could ever be different. I hoisted myself up on the edge of the building and looked straight down. Suddenly, the loud metal of the streets, the hot clanging of cars and buses went silent. I judged the distance and knew there would be only one result. I drew in a breath then, very slowly, very evenly, and prepared to let myself fall. I was in a state of almost thrilled relief and joy, and then I hesitated. In that brief moment, the brink of my coming release suddenly became the brink of terror. And I backed away from the edge, obviously. For me, that was an enormous turning point. I was on probation because I had been skipping all of my classes. but I started to sit Zen meditation right there and there. That was a sophomore in college. And the next quarter, I was on the dean's list. Things change. They change fast when you have to have them change. From the Zen perspective, to be wilted with disappointment, as the poet Jones Very suggests, is not necessarily such a bad thing. To see your life as a foolish pursuit of an impossible reality is to already have done two significant things. You have acknowledged the reality of suffering, Buddha's first noble truth, and you have entered onto the first part of the Buddha's noble eightfold path to liberation, right view, we call it. While there are many facets to understanding what it means to have right view, it is fundamentally about acknowledging the reality that life is characterized by suffering unless you do something about it. Doing something about it is not a step to be taken lightly. I have learned to be a bit suspicious of beginners who say that they want to throw themselves into Zen practice. Until they have a grip on the real nature of suffering, it's easy to persist in goal-oriented thinking, believing that 100% immersion in Zen will lead to happiness in the same way that people think cars and money and green lawns or being nominated to the Supreme Court, no, I didn't write that, will lead to it. When these eager beavers don't get happiness from Zen practice, they feel cheated, robbed, foolish, even angry. They often blame the teacher for their failure to find what they're looking for. The real problem, though, is that they have not yet recognized that they are truly and irrevocably lost. I say irrevocably. The wonderful song, Amazing Grace, I was lost and then found. You know, in Zen, we have that sense too, being lost and then found. But in Zen, because the path is circular, we always say it's circular, we're always lost. We can't change that. Everything is that turning point. You convert moment by moment. I don't mean to Buddhism. You convert yourself to the path moment by moment, turning, turning, going on. All this talk about the turning point is just to explain why it is that no one was ever born as a Buddhist. Every Buddhist is a convert to the Buddha way, even Siddhartha, the original Buddha. This is because every Buddhist is a person who has had to realize and accept the first noble truth, that life is characterized by suffering. You have to know that this truth applies to you. If you think you can hold some part of your life sacrosanct or that you can put it somewhere beyond the reach of suffering, then you're not yet at that fundamental turning point where Zen practice can really do its best work. But if you realize there's no escape from suffering, from being lost, then the words of teachers and Buddhas become powerful, surging with deep meaning throughout your whole life. When you hear the Dharma preached, it will seem like something you heard once a long time ago, or it will seem as though it were intended specifically for you. If you hear it deeply and clearly enough, you will hear it and see it everywhere. You will understand in a most intimate way what Jones Berry means when he writes, "The bird thou hearest on the budding tree, thou hast made sing with thy forgotten voice." These are perhaps my two favorite lines of poetry ever. How perfectly they express the essential reality. When you penetrate into the meaning of these lines, then you'll understand that the forest in which you're lost goes on forever. It covers the whole world. The forest is within you and without you. It is you. It's not possible to be lost in the woods if everything in the woods is the woods. It is not possible to be missing anything if everything is you. And as a challenge for my Zen readers, I have these short, they're called pointers. I'll just end with this thought. An ancient map on edgeless paper, a path drawn with invisible ink, following the compass of 10,000 hands, how do you find the way? Thank you so much for listening. Truly appreciate it.